Sun Tzu was an ancient general in ancient China, about 500 BC. He's known for writing a manual on military strategy. You probably have heard of it. It's called The Art of War. It's a short work. It's only a little longer in word count than two of my sermons. So, you know, really short. But despite its brevity, it's one of those documents that has continued to have a tremendous impact on military strategy. Now, if you read it, you don't have to be a military genius to understand much of it. For example, a central tenet in the Art of War is to both know yourself and your army's capabilities and to know that your enemy's strength and capabilities. Well, that seems kind of obvious, right? If you know what you can do and what your army can do, and if you know what your enemy's army can do, then you can strategize in such a way that you maximize your strengths and minimize your weaknesses while doing the opposite for those that you are fighting against. That's actually true in war. It's true in football and in basketball, and even in politics. But what's really interesting about this is the Art of War is less about actual military strategy and much more about the psychology of war and planning. Am I getting an echo? I keep hearing an echo. Am I the only one hearing that? Okay. Well, this is why Sun Tzu makes the stunning claim that the best victory is the one achieved without fighting. Whether you are a shrewd negotiator or you use subversion and trickery to convince the other army to not even fight, the best war is the one you do not fight. This requires, of course, a tremendous amount of planning, right? The strategy necessary to win a war without actually fighting can actually take decades. That's why you're prepared ahead of time. This could come by tricking the enemy into thinking your army is much larger than it is, whether that's through strategic troop movements. He has a massive army over there, and now there's even, or setting up far more tents than your army actually needs. If you can trick the enemy into fleeing a battlefield altogether, you can win a battle with minimal, if any, fighting. You just have to be a master strategist. When we read through the scriptures, what we're reading is God's strategy played out over the course of human history. As Paul wrote to the Galatians, it was in the fullness of time that God brought forth his son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem his people. That is, when God had orchestrated all of human history to just the right point, his son arrived, but not to engage in armed conflict. You see, God's strategy was the best strategy because his strategy did not involve fighting. Actually, it involved losing. And by losing, as we know, his victory would come by dying. What we've been seeing in the books of Judges and Ruth is this: God's long-term strategy played out over many, many years. Now, there are points of significant progress, things that stand out, but as we will see, there are also these long periods of time in which the shadow of the king was barely visible. Well, this morning we're in Ruth chapter 4 as we finish our series today. Ruth chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Abinadab. Abinadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. As we saw last week, having removed a significant hurdle from marrying Ruth, Boaz wastes no time. He marries her immediately. This takes place at the city gate where these transactions took place. It was in the presence of the 10 elders of the city and all the people who had gathered as witnesses. Boaz formally declared he was redeeming the land that belonged to Naomi, that it might remain in her late husband's clan, and he declared he was, in fact, marrying Ruth. Our text today picks up right there. So Boaz and Ruth marry fairly quickly, and she had a son 9-10 months later. Now, in chapter 1, when we first met Naomi, we find that she and her husband Elimelech had moved to Moab with their two sons. There was a famine in or around Bethlehem, and there wasn't one in Moab, and so they left their native land to go to this foreign country where there was food. So they get there, and Elimelech dies, as you know. Her sons marry Moabite women, and then her sons also died before either of them had children. Orpah, as you know, chose to return to her family so that she might remarry among them, but Ruth chose to remain with Naomi. Naomi finally hears that the Lord is blessing his people again, and so there are abundant crops being harvested, and so she decides to return, and Ruth returns with her. Now, when she gets there, you might recall, the women were surprised to see her. She had changed in those 10 years. Those were hard years for her, having lost her husband and both her sons. Now, her name, Naomi, means pleasant. But when she first arrived in Bethlehem, she told the women to not call her pleasant. Call her Mara. Mara means bitter. Life had, in fact, been bitter to her. As we saw, the narrator moved right past that, writing, "So Naomi," and just continued with the story. You see, what she did not know at the time was that the Lord had not, in fact, forgotten her. Yes, life had been hard. It had been bitter. The Lord had given her a difficult road to walk. And yes, the Lord could have intervened at any point, but what she had to learn is that the Lord would bring about his purposes in his time, not in hers. When we trust in the Lord's timing, everything is always better. Time and time again, we learn that waiting for the Lord is always better than grasping for something on our own. Unfortunately, this usually means waiting, because God's sense of time is most certainly not our sense of time. A day with the Lord is as a 1,000 years, and sometimes it feels like we wait 1,000 years. But things have changed for Naomi. It's interesting, the narrator seems to skip over Ruth at this point. Remember, Boaz was less interested in acquiring the land. He already had plenty of money, had plenty of resources. He didn't need land. Even though the land would be profitable, his goal was not for the land. His goal in all this was twofold. First, it was to provide for Naomi, the widow of his relative. But second, his goal was to marry Ruth. She was the real prize, so because everyone recognized she was a worthy woman. Now again, when we first met Naomi, she wanted to be called bitter. The Lord rejected her self-name change. So when Ruth gives birth to a son, the women bless the Lord for Naomi because the Lord had given her a redeemer. Her late husband's land would not be sold to a stranger, but would remain in her family. She has no biological connection to the child, however. In levirate marriage, if a son died, his brother would marry his widow, and their firstborn son would inherit the property, the inheritance of the dead son. There would be a genetic connection to the offspring. Ruth is not her daughter, and Boaz is not her son. Yet their firstborn son will inherit the land that belongs to Elimelech. Sorry, this is hitting me right now with Roger here. This is because covenant blessings and the offspring promised to Abraham were never limited to a person's DNA. Though Ruth is not her biological daughter, she has become Naomi's daughter in every other way. The bonds that hold them together are far stronger than shared ancestry. The love and commitment and loyalty she has shown Naomi has been profound. God has, in fact, given her a redeemer, one who would purchase her late husband's land and whose offspring would continue the covenant blessings to future generations. The women say the redeemer God has given her will be a restorer of life and a nourisher of her old age. Why? Because her daughter-in-law loves her. She is more to Naomi than seven sons. And thus the son born to Boaz and Ruth will be the true redeemer for Naomi and will receive the inheritance from Elimelech to his sons Kilian and Mahlon, all of whom have already died. And then strangely, the women name her son for her. They named him Obed. Now, the book of Ruth was clearly written after King David because we're told Obed was the father of Jesse and Jesse was the father of David. There's no need to point out which David because the reader already knew which David the writer was talking about. But then, strangely, the narrator gives another genealogy, this one more complete. We've already seen Obed was the father of Jesse and Jesse was the father of David, but he chooses to go back even further. And he begins with Perez. Now, we saw this earlier when the women and the people who witnessed this transaction taking place, they pronounced patriarchal blessings on Boaz and Ruth. They invoked the name of Perez. Now, first, they called upon the Lord to make Ruth like Rachel and Leah. They are the ancestors of all Israel. And then they invoked the name Perez. If you recall, Perez was the son of Tamar and the son of Judah. Boaz is from the tribe of Judah. He's from the clan of Ephrath, those who settled in and around Bethlehem. Tamar was Judah's daughter-in-law, and her husband died. Rather than his other son marrying her and giving her a son, he refused to do this. And so, as you know, the sordid story, Tamar disguised herself as a prostitute when Judah came by, and she had a son by him. The son was Perez. Now, often when we read a genealogy in Scripture, maybe this is just me, but our eyes tend to glaze over and we kind of skim that part and maybe look for something that's not a name and see if there might be something hidden in there. The fact is the names are foreign to us. Perez had Hezron. Hezron had a son named Ram. Ram had a son named Amminadab. Amminadab had a son named Nahshon, etc. Why is this important? Yes, it's how we get to David, but David won't be born for a couple more generations. Why are these names listed for us, especially after already being told, just the prior verse, who David comes from? He descends from Boaz, who had Obed, who had Jesse, who had David. Well, given the origin story of Perez, the rest of the genealogy is actually quite interesting because it shows God's hand at work. Again, these names don't really mean much to us, but if you look into Israel's history, some of these names will begin to stand out. Those in Boaz's day would have known all of this. They would recognize the names. And so they are, in fact, saying something extraordinary. Now remember, this is during the time of the judges. So some years before this story happens, Israel is in the wilderness and God makes a covenant with them. Remember, the entire point of the Exodus from Egypt was to give them a covenant. And the point of the covenant was actually the tabernacle. Through the tabernacle, God would dwell among his people, just as he had done in the garden prior to Adam's rebellion. This was always the intended purpose of the promises, including his original promise to Adam and Eve concerning an offspring who would one day destroy the serpent. It was always a promise for God to again dwell among his people. Now, while they're in the wilderness, each tribe was instructed to bring an offering for the tabernacle. Right? The priesthood of Israel would serve at the tabernacle and around the land of Israel without having its own allotment of land. They were the one tribe that did not receive specific territory. They got cities, but they did not receive a territory. Therefore, all Israel was to provide for the priests. They were set apart to serve the nation. So when Israel left Egypt, remember, they received reparations for their time in slavery, and they left Egypt extremely wealthy. The book of Exodus says they plundered Egypt. It was out of the abundance of what God had given them during the Exodus. They were to give generously to support the tabernacle and the priesthood. But we read about this particular offering in Numbers 7. There we're told that each tribal chief would, on behalf of the entire tribe, present an offering before the tabernacle. Now, the tribes were to present their offerings in a specific order, and it has nothing to do with birth order except for the first one. The first one was Judah, because Judah inherited the birthright, except Judah was the fourth born. Remember, there was first Reuben and Simeon, and then Levi, and finally you get to Judah. But Reuben and Simeon were disqualified from the birthright because they killed the men of Shechem. Levi didn't receive an inheritance because the priesthood was his inheritance, and so Levi did not receive the inheritance of all Israel, so it fell to Judah. So Judah presented, Judah was the first tribe to present the offering. After that, the tribes gave according to their position in the camp. Since Issachar was in Judah's camp, Issachar gave second. It had nothing to do with birth order after Judah. Now again, Judah presents first because Judah receives the birthright, and therefore Judah, being the largest tribe, but also being the most prominent tribe, was significant in presenting this first. But then we come in number 7 to the actual presentation of the offering, and some names might start to make some sense here, remembering that it's the tribal chiefs who presented them. He who offered his offering the first day was Nashon, the son of Amminadab, of the tribe of Judah. So you have Nashon, who is the son of Amminadab. He is the tribal chief over all Judah. That means, apart from Moses and then later Joshua, he was the most prominent individual in the entire nation. He was the leader of the biggest tribe, of the most prominent tribe, the tribe that would inherit the birthright. He was the father of Salmon. Salmon then was the son of the greatest tribal chief in all Israel. I mean, when Salmon was ready to marry, he was like the most eligible bachelor in all Israel. Like every girl wanted to marry Salmon. He's the son of the tribal chief, the greatest tribal chief. Here we, of course, Salmon was Boaz's father. And here we see part of why Boaz was so highly regarded in Bethlehem. His grandfather had been the greatest individual tribal chief in all Israel. This partly explains his wealth and his influence. I mean, when a guy like Boaz tells you at the city gate, sit right here and I'll come back to you, you sit. You don't need further explanation. You sit because Boaz told you to sit while he goes off and does something else. When a guy like Boaz starts calling together 10 village elders, you're like, oh, okay, I'll wait to find out what Boaz needs us for. Everyone would have known the name of Boaz. So this tells us something about Boaz. But there's still a missing piece. Who is his mother? Who did Salmon marry to produce Boaz? Well, for that, we have to turn to a very different genealogy. Matthew begins his gospel, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Notice that genealogy. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, starting to notice the names, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab. That Rahab. His mother was Rahab, the former Canaanite prostitute. Remember, when Joshua led Israel into the land, the first fortress they came to was the city of Jericho. It was really just a fortress with villages around it. Rahab, remember, told the spies that they were all in fear of the God of Israel. They had heard the stories of the God of Israel, and then she told them why they were filled with fear, because, quote, the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Because of her faith in the God of Israel, she and her entire family were spared in the destruction of the city. Now, Joshua doesn't tell us what happened to her after this, but Matthew does. She marries the son of the tribal chief of all Judah. She and Salmon later had Boaz. And now we see why Boaz was so concerned for Ruth's reputation when she came to him at the threshing floor, which was usually a place of great immorality. Now we see why Boaz is so concerned for Naomi, a poor widow with no one to protect her. His own mother had once been exploited. Boaz was not about to contribute to that exploitation. Boaz wasn't at all concerned about his wife's ethnicity because his own mother was a Canaanite. And what we're seeing in the book of Judges and Ruth is God's hand as it has been functioning throughout human history, right? God has been at work from the beginning to bring about his purposes. As I mentioned, his purposes culminate in the arrival of Jesus. Paul referred to this in his letter to the Galatians. He said, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under the law. When the fullness of time came, Christ came. In his letter to the Corinthians, Paul told them that speaking of things that had happened centuries prior, he said, they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end or the purpose, the outcome of the ages has come. 1 Corinthians 10:11. In Ephesians, he said, God sent Jesus as a plan for the fullness of time. Ephesians 1:10. Mark tells us when Jesus began his public ministry, he declared, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Mark 1:15. Quite simply, God had orchestrated human history to this very point that he himself might come to earth as a human, in the form of a human, in order to fulfill all of his purposes for this world. This had literally, up to this point, taken all of human history to bring about. Talk about playing a long game. This work began in the Garden of Eden. God had a strategy in place from the beginning. That's why in Genesis 3, we read of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day that he might walk with Adam and Eve. I mean, can you imagine seeing God's shadow in the garden as he comes walking up to you late in the evening? Now, in the garden, it would have been an actual shadow because he appeared in physical form. He was not yet human, but he appeared in physical form to him. Of course, in Genesis 3, all is not well because Adam rebels against God and he and Eve hid themselves from God's presence. The church, God was not content with this. Now, keep in mind who we're talking about when we talk about God here. John tells us in 1 John 1 that no one has seen God. In fact, the only God, the Son, he's seen the Father, and he is the one who reveals the Father to us. So it wasn't God the Father walking in the garden because no one has seen God the Father. And of course, the Holy Spirit is Spirit. What this means is the person of the Trinity walking in the garden is the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, before he took on human form. Now, because God was not content to allow Adam and Eve and their offspring, that means us, to remain trapped in sin and death, he had to intervene. So we're told he made animal skins to cover their nakedness. That is, the Son of God, foreshadowing what he himself would one day do, shed the blood of animals as the first sacrifice in order to cover their sin. Now, sometime after this, humanity has been multiplying. There was great wickedness. Men and women began to commit great evil. But again, God was not content to let them remain trapped in sin and death, so he intervened. He determined he would destroy the world and he would start over with a new humanity. That's why we're told in Genesis 6:8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. God saved Noah and his family, and from them began to repopulate the entire world. The new start would not last long. Within several generations, men and women began worshiping idols once again. There was one particular family that was involved in this, living in ancient Ur. Even though humanity had once again pursued outright rebellion again, God was not satisfied with them being trapped in sin and death, so he intervened. Although this intervention would be very different from his prior interventions, because in this time to intervene, God would make a promise. So God appeared to a man named Abram, later named Abraham, and he called him to leave his father's house and go to a land God would show him. God promised him he would make his name great, that he would multiply his offspring. And then the whole point of all these promises would culminate in this one. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. In Abraham and in Abraham's offspring, all the families of the earth would be blessed. Here we begin to see God's default disposition toward the world he created. He loves his world. He said it was very good in the beginning. God desires to bless, not to curse. When he showed up in Eden, it was to bless Adam and Eve with his presence. When he showed up in Noah's day, yes, he had shown up in judgment, but it was also to bless the world because he was starting over with a new humanity. Here he issues an incredible promise to a man named Abraham, a promise that could not and would not depend on Abraham. You see, when God appeared to him, Abraham was one of those who worshiped idols. Joshua 24 tells us Terah was the father of Abraham and Nahor, and then tells us they, all of them, worshiped idols. But God took Abraham out of there and led him to a land that he would show him, the land of Canaan. And when he was there, he began to cause his offspring to grow. God had made a promise, and God began to keep that promise. That promise, remember, centers on blessing all the nations on earth. God's plan for his world was always to include the nations. His people were never supposed to be a monoethnic people. Many years after making this promise to Abraham, Abraham's descendants had grown to about 70 people or so, and they made their way to Egypt. As they grew and multiplied in Egypt, of course, they were enslaved. We know that story. Because of God's promise to Abraham, he intervened once again and rescued Israel from Egypt. Remember, though, his promise was for the nations. We're told the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses in Egypt to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. So in addition to, or perhaps it could be that they helped make up the 600,000, but in addition to ethnic Israelites, you have this group that are the mixed multitude who joined the Israelites in the Exodus. They were there. They had witnessed God's power on display in the plagues. And so they were choosing to cast their lot with Israel and Israel's God. Now, what's truly remarkable about that statement, that a mixed multitude went up to him, is its context. The plundering of Egypt. At the time, Egypt was the world power. International trade was very common. We know this historically. Part of what gave Egypt its wealth was its wealth of people, men and women from all over the world who traveled there for work and for business, whether they lived there or visited and then left. Now, when Israel leaves in the Exodus, the Egyptians gave them gold and silver and jewelry and clothing. This was Israel's plunder of Egypt. They were being paid for many years of slavery. However, there's more plunder. In a wonderful article, Old Testament scholar Aaron Sherwood argues that while Israel's plunder was gold and silver, God's plunder was far more valuable. So thus the significance of the mixed multitude in Exodus 12:38 is that at the moment of their deliverance, God's people comprises Israelites and non-Israelites, that is, the representatives of the nations that he promised to bless, who are his spoils. They are Yahweh's spoils won from Egypt. So Israel plunders gold and silver. God plundered people. Do you see that? God plundered people from Egypt. Together, this mixed group of people traveled to Mount Sinai with Moses. While at Mount Sinai, God gave them a covenant. He gave all of them a covenant. Native Israelite and the mixed multitude. He told them at Mount Sinai, if they together would be careful to obey him and to keep his covenant, they combined, all of them, regardless of their ancestry, would be his treasured possession among all the nations. So they together, all of them, Israelite and mixed multitude, became the people of God. Thus we see from the very beginning God's love for the nations. His promise to Abraham to bless all the families of the earth was always in view, even in the Exodus, even in the formation of the people of Israel. This is why we see people like Caleb, who is a Kenizzite, one of the Canaanite tribes. That's why we see people like Othniel, his nephew, and Rahab, and Aksa, and Moses' own wife, and Eleazar, his brother's daughter-in-law. They were non-native Israelites. They were from other nations, and yet they were counted among the people of Israel because of their faith in the God of Israel. This means from the beginning, we're seeing God's hand, his presence, his shadow has been seen throughout human history, guiding it to its ultimate aim. Well, after the conquest of the land of Canaan, the people of Israel didn't obey God's voice. That's what Judges is all about. They worshipped other gods. They bowed down to them. God disciplined his people, yet they would quickly, after being rescued from that discipline, would turn back and become even worse in their idolatry. Remember how the book of Judges ends? Very dire. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. What an ominous end to a book that, at least on its surface, is a depressing book. I think we all felt it as we worked our way through it. And yet, throughout the book, we saw glimpses that God was at work, even though his people were, for the most part, unfaithful. And then we come to the book of Ruth, which is set early in the time of the judges. In the generation that entered the land was a Canaanite woman named Rahab, who came to recognize the God of Israel as the true God, She married Salmon, the son of Israel, Judah's tribal chief, and they had a son named Boaz, a faithful and righteous Israelite. But let's place this story in the context a little more precisely. Rahab was part of the generation of the conquest, that first generation in the land, the generation that remained faithful. Well, faithful-ish. The elders who outlived Joshua were the next generation. They too remained faithful because they were little kids and they saw God's mighty hand at work in the conquest. They heard those stories firsthand from mom and dad. But we read, after that arose a new generation who did not know the Lord or the works that he had done, and they went and worshiped other gods. This is Boaz's generation. Boaz remained faithful to the Lord in a day in which the overwhelming majority of Israel turned away from the Lord altogether. But here again, we see God's hand at work. His shadow is moving among his people, preserving a remnant. Now, his shadow, it's our smarty word for the kiddos, his shadow is the hidden presence and activity of God. Just because you cannot see him doesn't mean he is not there. His shadow is always there. Now, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, except for the faithful remnant. God was preserving a faithful remnant because while Israel had forgotten God's covenant, God could never forget his covenant. He made a promise to Abraham to bless all the nations of the earth, and even if Israel would not fulfill it, God would. That's why the author tells us Salmon fathered Boaz, Boaz fathered Obed, Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. Ruth is the only book in the Bible that ends with a name, indicating David's importance, not only to the story of Ruth or the story of Judges, but of the story of the entire Bible. You see, just as God made a covenant with Abraham and then began to fulfill that covenant with his covenant given at Mount Sinai, so God would make a covenant with David. 2 Samuel 7. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come from your body. I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. While the initial fulfillment of this covenant was Solomon, including God's discipline of Solomon when his kingdom was torn into after he died, there is a far greater fulfillment of this covenant. We've already read about it in Matthew's gospel. His gospel is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That is, Jesus is the offspring promised to Abraham, the very offspring who would bless all the families of the earth. He is the offspring promised to David, the very offspring who would sit on an eternal throne. And though he himself would not sin, he would receive the weight of the sins of his people. The Apostle Paul makes an astonishing declaration, a claim in his letter, second letter to the Corinthians. Now keep in mind God's promise to Adam and Eve that their offspring would one day destroy the serpent and end the very sin of death Adam allowed into God's good world. And remember the promise to Noah that God would create a new humanity through him. And the promise to Abraham that he would bless all the families of the earth through Abraham's offspring. And the promise to Israel that they would be to him a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And the promise to David that David's offspring would sit on an eternal throne. This is what God said about these promises. For all the promises of God find their yes in him. That is why it is through him, through Jesus, we utter our amen to God for his glory. How many promises are fulfilled in Jesus? All of them. All of them. Remember the very purpose of the Exodus. It was the tabernacle. Everything God was doing in human history was so that God would dwell among his people. This is why Isaiah prophesied that a virgin would conceive and she would bear a son and he would be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. God has been working out his plan, his strategy from the very beginning, culminating with God's intended outcome, God with us. You know, to win at anything, I don't care if it's war or checkers or football, you have to have a strategy, right? But a strategy only works if you have a specific goal in mind that you want to achieve. I mean, no one goes to war simply to go to war. There's got to be a reason you're going to war because that drives your strategy. It might be riches or land or power. How you would go after those things, it would be different. You may just go in and steal and then retreat. But if you want land, you go in, you occupy. It changes how you fight. You don't fight to the last man on a training exercise, right? So you may go to war just to keep your soldiers sharp, but minor skirmishes here and there to keep them on their toes. But you don't fight to the last man. Your strategy changes. Well, in a very real sense, God is the original author of the art of war. From the very beginning of human history, from the moment of creation, God had a strategic plan in place. And this plan is to bless the world. His strategy involved going to war against the principalities of this world. That is, the spiritual forces of evil out there that are arrayed against us. But God has orchestrated the events of human history in all the circumstances necessary to fulfill his mission. And it culminates in the coming of the Lord Jesus. The incredible thing here is that this is what he is doing in each of our lives. When Naomi was widowed and then lost her sons, she had no way of knowing how life would be anything but bitter. She had no way of knowing that at the time. Rahab was trapped in a life of shame and was used and abused by many others. She had no way of knowing that one day one of her close descendants would be king of all Israel. You probably remember the words of John Piper. We've talked about these quite a bit. God is always doing 10,000 things in your life. And you may be aware of three of them. Listen, if God could handle the countless details necessary to bring human history to the birth of Jesus, born at just the right time with a near universal language and a system of roads built by a foreign power that provided relative security and freedom to travel, and he was born to a young woman who happened to be a descendant of David, who was engaged to be married to a man who also happened to be descendant of David, even though he wasn't his biological father, he was his legal father. If God can handle all of those details, then surely he can be trusted to handle the mere 10,000 things in your life. I mean, what's 10,000 things compared to all of human history? Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, God's strategy for total victory was to die. In order to die, he first became human, took on the ability to die. He became human so that he might first live the life you and I were supposed to live, and then die the death you and I were supposed to die. And thus, his resurrection is the very thing that finally and completely defeated the true enemy, sin and death. But even in this, even in his unjust and cruel death, he was no victim. He had presented himself as the offering for sin, ensuring all who would trust in him would be saved. His victory was achieved when they nailed him to the cross, and it was absolute when he walked out of his tomb on the third day. But this is why you and I can trust him with our lives, with every single detail of it, including the details we don't know anything about. So often we cannot see God working. So often it seems he's focusing on 9,997 things that we don't know about, and therefore we assume he's not, in fact, working. But the message of Judges and Ruth is that even in the worst of times, God's shadow looms large across your life. He is involved in every detail. He's working out his plans and his purposes, even in the things we cannot comprehend, the things we cannot understand. God is ever present, working out his plans. The outcome of this is as simple as it is profound. God with us. Well, after spending the last 11 months in the books of Judges and Ruth, I have to be honest, my perspective has changed. What I initially thought, along with many of you I know, was that the book of Judges was discouraging and mostly depressing, something that we had to endure. You see, it's quite easy for us to believe that God is with us in the good times. Of course he is. I mean, when the church is growing, when your job is productive, when your family is thriving, when the church church unity seems to come just almost on autopilot, when your health is excellent, you know, when things are good, of course God is with us. It is so much easier to forget his promises when a relationship shatters, or when your health begins to fail, or money is suddenly tight, or your job becomes incredibly stressful. But if we're able to see, as we have in Judges and Ruth, that God is just as active during these times as he is in the good times, then knowing God is at work, even when you cannot see the evidence, this knowledge should soothe the storms in our lives, the ones that get deep into our souls. These two books urge us to look for God's handiwork when times are difficult. Church, we may only catch glimpses of his shadow, but his shadow proves his presence.